Hey, this is Dr. Alex Wills. Welcome to another episode of Give a Fuck Actually. Today we're here with my friend and wine connoisseur, Benjamin Wasby of Le Bois Winery down here on Bannock Street in downtown Boise. He's a serial entrepreneur, student of wine and people.
Thanks so much for having me on your podcast. Frankly, I got to be honest with you, as a professional wine clown, I have no idea why I'm here, but I'm excited for the adventure anyway.
This is my psychotherapist. After work, I'll stop by and have a little glass of wine. And he's a really great listener and is full of wisdom and definitely a student of people for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Over the course of the years that I've been doing this, Alex, it's just been so interesting to me. I get to talk to hundreds of people every single weekend, and they all come from different places, have amazing stories to tell. I'm just lucky enough to capture some of that information, retain bits and pieces of it, and just really get to connect with the community around me. That's what I focus on.
And it shows you have just a depth of stories and you have a love for people that just like shines through. So that's great. A little bit of background about you. Do you want to maybe share a bit of your origin story?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, most of this comes from my family. So my mother's side of the family is all from France, and they were deeply involved in the wine industry for many generations. And so as a young man, I was lucky enough to grow up in a world where some of that was still holding on. My great-grandfather and my grandfather and my uncle were interested in the business. And as I traveled back and forth between the United States and France to visit family, I had a chance to really just figure out how beautiful the agricultural lifestyle really is. There's nothing better for me personally than actually picking something up, watching it grow, and kind of building into something. Get real actual tangible, results from the work that you do when you're working with your hands and working with the land. Not saying that other people in other jobs don't get that, but it's very, very right there in front of your face. And I need, as an achiever, someone who loves to get stuff done, I like to be able to see it, what I'm doing.
That's great. And you've had vineyards before, or yeah, the whole production from beginning to end. How does that all work?
I really wanted to focus on, because in the industry that I work in, it's kind of complicated because it's kind of segmented into people who are just focused on production. And then there are those who are kind of sitting in this middle ground of import and distribution. And then there's finally the retailers, the place that we actually see the people interact and interface with the wines itself. And I wanted an understanding of all of it, not just one specific piece. So early on in my career, I worked in import and distribution. So that was my job, to go gather interesting wines from all over the world, bring them to the United States, have some fun with them, take them out to retailers and move around. But eventually I got to the point where my knowledge with that was only so thick and so interesting. And I figured to myself, well, I want to actually know, how does the vineyard actually work? Not just on a uber level where I have an understanding because I read in a book, but I actually want the scars and the calluses that come with actually doing that work. So that's when my wife and I left Atlanta, Georgia, where I was working that job in import and distribution, moved out to Hood River, Oregon, and we started on that journey. It was one of those many times in my career where you almost have to take several steps backwards to move several steps forward, right? Mm-hmm. So I left behind a really good paying job, nice salary, company car, good expense account, all that kind of stuff, to go make $13 an hour sweeping the floor of a small up-and-coming winery out in Washington. And I knew nothing. I was setting up for all that I knew. I think that's what happens to me sometimes when I do take these steps back to take these steps forward. For all that I think I know, I realize, well, I don't know what I'm doing. But the humility to go along the way and just kind of understand that I'm here for the process to learn and be open to it. A bunch of mistakes along the way. And then I basically kind of just continued to grow in that world of actual wine production and vineyard management, all the way to the fact of where I had my own place, my own vineyard, my own wineries, tasting room and wine bar, kind of similar to what we have down here. And so by managing all those different components, I was able to get a fully rounded version of what it is my career is like.
Sounds very fulfilling, and you seem to be a very happy, fulfilled person. Yeah. Has it paid off? And what's next? Are you just sort of enjoying the ride right now?
Oh, I mean, this is the honeymoon phase for me. This is what I'm currently doing right now. So everything that I had in Hood River, I've slowly divested myself of over the past number of years, which has been kind of heart-wrenching in some way, because you build up a baby and you take care of it and you watch it go and walk and it does all these amazing things. I mean, to set that aside to say, I've actually got something else interesting I want to do in this world that's not only hard for myself personally because of the relationships and because of the hard work put into those places, but also just because starting over from zero is just, if you already have something very comfortable, that's not the move most people make. Is that I've got a feeling, it works, it's working well. Why would I all of a sudden shift in? But again, going back to that, like taking a few steps backwards to move forwards, I feel like it's just necessary, at least for my personality, to constantly put myself under great deals of stress. I am really well under pressure. So I've found that for myself, a lot of times I just have to force pressure on myself. If I feel like I'm stagnating, if I feel like I'm not really achieving the goals that I want to, or if I'm just not getting satisfaction at what it is I'm doing, I actually will literally make up things that aren't even there just to push myself even further, which I don't know how healthy that is, but it seems to work okay.
You made me a bit of the lead singer of Tool, Maynard.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do you do if you're a rock star and you are wildly successful?
Right.
You need money, then you know what you can do with. You go and you start to create wines and you start to work the earth and get the scars. And so great minds must think alike.
I hope so. And we make some amazing wines as well. But what's interesting about it, though, too, for me personally, is just like watching all the people that wander in and out of our industry of wine. While many of them are, you know, ripers like myself, they started up with maybe their family under winery or their uncle had some land and or something like that. Many times, especially later on in life, there's a lot of people that join us in where they were therapists or they were surgeons or they were doctor or whatever they were. And they, for whatever reason, kind of fall back into this, something that has just been done for, well, thousands of years, but seems to just have a very, very peaceful way of life about it. And so regardless of whether anyone enters it at the beginning or whether they just come in later in life, I don't know. It's just, there's a pull to it that's kind of hard to describe. I don't know.
Yeah. I noticed at your wine store there, it's like a really a community building kind of thing. You get people that are just barely into it starting off, and then you get some of the older folks coming in, and it's the closest thing I've ever had to a cheers.
Yeah.
Everybody knows your name, you know, it's
the idea. Yeah. I mean, for all I can wax nerdy and poetical about wine and how it's made, and or look at the beautiful falcon over the vineyard in the twilight of the moon, and then there was also a rainbow. You know, like there's all that kind of thing that you can read the back of a label and try to get evoke some sort of emotion out of you. But fundamentally, take away all the wine out of my space. What do I really have? I just have people, and that's what really matters to me. So even though the wine and the information about it is a vehicle to open up a conversation and loosen people up a little bit and get them relaxed, truthfully, I mean, the bedrock of what it is I do for a living is not only just meet people and interact with them myself, but see where I can get them interacting together. Hmm. And that can sometimes be my greatest challenge. I had an example of that over this past weekend where I'm pretty good at sizing up people the moment they walk into the establishment, where they're at on their day. Are they coming off of work and you can just see that they've got all the weight of the world on their shoulders and they just need a distraction. They just need me to just be kind of goofy and ask them about anything else in their life besides what they do for a living. Or are they coming in and they're coming in and it's like a couple and maybe like things are a little contentious and I got to kind of figure that way around. Whenever I had people come into the space and I'm doing a size up, my goal is to try to pull them into my world a little bit, knowingly or unknowingly, whether they're aware of it or not. I'm gently attempting to bring them into my world a little bit to say, hey, we're here to relax, to meet new people, to have some fun. And also, and I think one of the most important things for me is not just sit here and talk to me, but also all the people on this bar, for the most part, looking for connections or conversation or just something to do with their time. Plus I'd sit, look at a glass of wine and stare at the wall for an hour and a half and hope that I stop by and say something somewhat witty and amusing, which 50% chance of that.
Well, it's really a great experience. And how long have you been here at this place in Boise?
I got the lease for this back in June, so not even a year ago.
Yeah.
And then we only opened up in August because we had to wait for permitting and, you know, the city to say yes on everything. So barely been a year at this point. I got to tell you, I mean, this was coming to a new community and a new city and a new space where I wasn't really familiar with, you know, just the general like feeling around town. I visited a lot. I had an understanding of it from a very surface level. But I didn't really understand how this place was going to work or operate, or if even anyone would care that I put this place, you know, down on Bannock Street. So as I went through those first few weeks, it was fairly what I expected. Kind of slow, made some really good connections with some people. But then lately, it's just taken off in a way that is just, I'm barely holding onto the reins, I feel like sometimes.
Yeah, it gets pretty busy in there.
People haven't even time. That's the point.
Awesome. So in this podcast, we're doing a bit of an experiment as we kind of touched on following our emotions where they may go. And I was curious if you had anything that came to mind of any difficult, uncomfortable, scary unpleasant emotions that we normally might want to just kind of get rid of and fix and like not have to deal with. Anything going on for you recently, something from the past, anything that you wanted to maybe share?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where my desire to really like just pull people into an interesting or kind of like a, I don't know, just a joyless state. That is where I like to people to see. That's where I like to see people like hanging out down here in the Tasty Room. I want them to be experiencing joy and relaxation and just really, really having some good feelings. However, I know for myself that that's not something that, while mainly in that space, it's set up for me to be able to like weave and control and pull different pieces in different ways to give them that experience, to bring them up to that level. In other areas of my life, that's neither my job nor my responsibility for other people. So I guess it's that battle internally of, you know, like a great example is my son. I've got 5 kids and they're all very vastly different, a beautiful different like pieces of myself, of my parents, of my wife, and of her parents, and the families going back in any direction. But there are certain parts of their personalities that like I understand, I can see either from me or from her or from our extended family, but that it's, I want to pull that joy out of them. But sometimes that's not what they need from me as a father or as a husband or as a spouse, is not to be that person who's like, hey, I know you're going through something difficult right now, but let me just say something wild or crazy or distract you from something. Something staying very present and focused in that moment and allowing them, like my son, like I was saying, he's like the most, he's so interesting. He's so my father in so many ways, which is a good thing because, you know, my dad's a great guy, but he just has a tendency to, when he's looking at any given situation, his thoughts just go to, okay, how could something mess up here? How could something like go wrong? And granted, he's only 6 years old. I mean, he doesn't have the full totality of understanding that a grown person would, but I recognize that in him. And it's something that I have to consider as I'm talking to him, not always be like, hey, don't think about things that way. Hey, don't do that. Hey, no. Put your mind in like a happy place, because him experiencing and going through those emotions is his journey. And that's the way that he views this world. And I don't, I see it all. I've got rose colored glasses every day. But there are people outside in this world who don't, and that's their journey, and being understanding of his portion of that and saying, hey, your perspective is just as valid as mine. And sometimes when he's thinking about things that go wrong, they're actually quite pragmatic. You know, they're not necessarily, I mean, granted, again, 6-year-old. So like, let's not all panic about like he's like predicting the future. But at the same time, he has the ability to just sort of look around in a situation that would be like, hey, everything's great. And the sun's just, you know, coming out every day. And he's like, it's actually kind of muddy and rainy outside, and I don't want to go to the park or whatever it is. I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's fair to have. Mm-hmm. But I guess that balance of understanding where people are at, I don't know if that's necessarily negative emotion, but it's certainly something I've been working on lately, which is coming to terms with the world doesn't have to operate according to one set of perspectives, whether it be in the positive or whether it be more pragmatic, or I mean, if we want to, you know, if we want to pejoratize it, take it negative. But still, just being able to like run those two things in my mind simultaneously and be like, hey, that's fine with everybody.
Right. Yeah. You know, those emotions, joy, you don't have to ask me twice. It's like, yeah, sign me up.
Yeah. Any day. Yeah, sure. I'll take it.
I'll take all the joy all the time that I can get. Wait, what emotions come up for you when you notice that he is kind of worried and, you know, kind of down, maybe, you know, overly serious? What emotions do you notice for you?
I think for me, it's... If it's a moment where I actually have time and patience for him, which again, with having 5 children, I have to divide myself many different ways. So if we are in a moment where I can actually sit down, get on his level, and really just talk him through everything, well, then, you know, this can lead to some really interesting and beautiful moments between us of really understanding each other as father and son. Hmm. However, as unfortunately is the case in a busy family where there's soccer practice and then it's time for cheerleading and we're late to this and then this has to happen and then someone's calling me from work, in those other moments, it's frustration with like, come on, just get on the program, buddy, and let's move along to the next thing so that we can just like, you know, make the best of whatever the situation is. So finding that patience in those really, really tight moments where there's so much going on, I mean, that easily brings out that frustration and just like, hey, just we've talked through this kind of idea many, many times before. And it's not so much frustration at him as an individual. Mm-hmm. It's frustration at, okay, there's so much going on right now. I cannot give you all the things that I want to give you. I cannot make the spotlight shine on you as much as I would like it to. Hmm. I have other places that I got to look and I have other things I have to do. So I have to give you a little soundbite. And for a 6-year-old mind, oftentimes it's not enough for him. He needs that long conversation, but he just has to suffice with the quick, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way, but you got to get in the car because we want to get in the car. I don't have time for a 30-minute like dialogue back and forth about how, well, I don't know, you don't want to wear a jacket or whatever. Whatever is destroying his world at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. So underneath that frustration, it sounds maybe some disappointment. You know, again, it's not his fault. It's not your fault. It's just, you know, it's the situation. You can't help it. So there's some disappointment. I imagine he's feeling disappointment.
Exactly.
You're feeling disappointment. And you should be, because that's the emotion that's coming up, right?
Exactly.
What do you feel like the point is of disappointment? Why do we have that emotion as humans if it's not just there to make us feel even shittier about the situation?
I guess I have two minds of that. So on the one point, I think disappointment is actually quite a functional and very helpful emotion to have, simply because when things don't go well or the way that you had intended or the way that you'd planned, a little bit of disappointment, at least for me personally, that's motivation for, okay, the next time that I run across this situation or next time I see this thing, that disappointment can actually push one to do better or find different solutions or work around it a little bit. So I see it from, I mean, you know, capitalists would love the sound of this, which is like, you're disappointed, you didn't get the thing you wanted, work harder. I don't want it to sound like that because that's aggressively not who I am as a person. So I know that sounds a little bit capitalistic from like that standpoint. But then on the other side of like disappointment, I feel as though experiencing true loss, whether it's loss of a moment with my son or loss of an object or I didn't get what I wanted, I feel like understanding loss, which is a huge part of existence in this life, we don't keep everything we have. We're constantly shedding our own skin cells at a rate that's just like aggressive. I say that just because I was outside for the past few days and I know it's coming for me. But to have that understanding and to be okay with the fact that things are quite ethereal and fleeting, loss is also something that we just simply have to come to terms with. Now, how we use that and how that serves us, not to be too flippant about it. On one side, you can be flippant about it and just say, okay, well, life is loss. And so therefore nihilism, nothing really matters. Who cares? Let's just let it all go. But also loss can actually teach you the value of something you care about, because rarely are you ever disappointed about something that doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I think, you know, when you have those opportunities for those precious moments with your son and they're lost, you can't do anything about it. Got to get to soccer practice. There's just, it's gone. Then there is that sadness. And, you know, if you didn't value the relationship, if you didn't really, you know, want those moments to last forever, then you wouldn't have that emotion. So it's sort of a reminder of how much you love him and how much you do care about those things. So without that disappointment, you know, we wouldn't really have that emotional radar to make us aware of like what really is important in life in a way.
Well, exactly. And I don't know, it's that expectations are kind of like sort of like definitely like fused with disappointment, because it's really, really hard to go this life and not look at other people or other situations or other things that you wander through and not have expectations. I feel like a lot of people, especially, and you know, from all my time and all the people that I've spoken to, like down in the bar, sometimes the expectations are positive things for the most part. I mean, you can skew that a few different ways, but those expectations that we put on other people is like, if I do this, I need to expect a reaction. Like, you almost respect, whether you knowingly or unknowingly have that in you, you expect something to happen. And so turning down expectations is not the best way to fight it, but it's a good way to sort of temper that disappointment, especially in regards to other people.
Right.
The universe is, from my understanding is, I mean, it's somewhat neutral, right? It doesn't care what happens to us either way. We just will exist. Things will happen. That's just the nature of it. But in other humans and other people that we interact with, I find people constantly, and I've done this so much of my life. This is probably the majority of the therapy that I've done, not with you, just a disclaimer, there's no professional circle. There's pretty many tricks. That's all. But from my own journey through therapy, that's always been like the main thing that I've really had to like work on and focus on is expectations and understanding that, whether it's my wife or my parents, just settling those down a little bit, because inevitably that disappointment doesn't sting as much when you're like, all right, this is the way they chose to react to this, and it's fine, and that's it. You just really easy to say into a microphone on the top of a building. In practice, it's a lifelong journey.
Another way to maybe look at it too is when you're doing, arena, we can kind of try to control emotions and try to minimize those negative emotions that people call negative is by playing it safe,
Right.
And if we try to play it safe all the time, then we can really temper our expectations so that we, if you don't expect too much, you're not going to get let down.
Well,
famous lyrics to that song. But is that really a good way to live your life? Or it's more of a choice. You can say, hey, I'm going to go for something that I really want. If I don't get it, I'm going to be really disappointed.
Right.
I'm going to risk a lot. I can lose a lot. If it doesn't work out, I'm fucked.
Right.
And we still say, I'm going to have those painful emotions, but I want to live my life. I'm going to go for it or not. And I mean, I guess it's an individual choice in each situation. How do you think of it that way?
Well, I mean, that just speaks to me on so many ways, because that those weekends that I have, those connections that I have with people, when I'm really, really just crushing, like, and you've seen those nights down at the bar where it's just there's a specific din, whether it's a restaurant or a bar. And by din, I mean just like a level of noise, a level of laughter and levity that's happening in a room that it, for me anyway, it's quite tangible. But those nights are only as interesting or as fun because, well, just last weekend, I totally screwed it up with those people. And I guess to answer it is like, I mean, experiencing the swings of life of both the good and the bad, you can't appreciate those wonderful moments where you actually slayed and you went out for the job and you nailed the interview and you got it. Unless three interviews prior, you totally whiffed on that and it totally didn't make sense. If we were all always winning, would we experience any amount of, I mean, this is one of my favorite and I look forward to the comments, but like, this was one of my favorite movies of childhood, adolescence, really was focused on. It was Zach Braff's movie Garden State. Right now, it's a fun movie. Zach Braff, Natalie Portman, they go through this like kind of journey, like just through a bunch of different things surrounding his mother's death. But the whole focus and point of the movie was like, unless you experience some of the lows, the highs are never going to feel that interesting. And if you attempt to live a life that is just right in the middle, just neutral, you'll have neither high highs or low lows. You'll exist. You'll do something, but you're going to miss out on something of the learning process of going through a tough time and the pure ecstasy of crushing.
Yeah, that's so well said. And I resonate with that. It's like, do you want to live a life that's truly lived?
Yeah.
Or do you want to play it safe? And, when you're on your deathbed, look back and say, hey, I made it. Nothing really bad happened. I didn't get let down. And I didn't really feel like I had a real life either.
Right. And that is not that it terrifies me in a way, because up to this point, being 36 years old, it's been pedaled to the metal most of the time. So I have very few. I'm lucky enough that I don't have a ton of regrets. Of course, I have some. But for the things that I've been able to accomplish and do, I feel like for the life that I was given, for the places that I was put and the situations I was given, I've been able to maximize on as many of them as possible while still experiencing a lot of loss along the way and a lot of disappointment. And that's been a good journey for me.
In real time right now, you're kind of helping me. I'm always trying to think of more emotionally woke ways to live. Woke in sort of a good positive sense, political, whatever. But just this idea that maybe if our expectations were not about the outcome of things, like I'm going to get this job, I'm going to crush it, I'm going to have the success, I'm going to make this money, whatever it might be. If our expectations were simply to have the full emotional experience, so that no matter what happens, you decide to not go for something, you decide to go for something else, you decide to risk a lot, and you're going to either have those high highs or those low lows because of it. And none of it's bad. If we can get past this idea that emotions are negative or bad, or that we should try to fix them or avoid them, then we get to have the full spectrum and let that be okay. Because at the end of the day, painful emotions are just painful emotions. They're temporary. They're just there to tell us some truth about what happened and help us to go on in a wiser way. So
yeah, that's the idea. And for people who do struggle with that, I don't know. There was an advice from a shrink years ago that he told me, which is, and it's very common sense sounding, but he said to me at a particularly interesting time in my life where I was try to battle with some of these things that we're talking about. He said, you know what, Benjamin, here's the thing to remember is there's always a way forward. Now, it may not be pleasant or comfortable or easy, but there's always a way forward. And it's simply just do the work, put your foot in front of another and continue to move, even if it's not necessarily the direction you want to.
Mm.
It is happening. And what little control we have over some portions of our lives, we do have a great amount of control in other parts of our lives, and to steer our thoughts towards where we do actually can control. And by control, I don't mean this like, I don't mean this like guilded feudalism, you know, like tyrannical control over this. It's a very loose grip that we have on reality anyway. But still, what it is we can do in our own existence, that is something that is to be focused on and to be celebrated, I feel like, even though it can be uncomfortable.
Yeah, you know, are you comfortable going a bit deeper with something, anything, examples coming up of when have you like really struggled yourself the most? What kind of the deepest, most intense, overwhelming, dark emotions? You know, anything coming to mind that you'd feel comfortable talking
about? Sure, absolutely.
No obligation is like,
I understand. No. I mean, for me, that would be the moment. I mean, this was barely about a year ago when we had first moved here to Boise, and we knew that we wanted to start a new business. We'd already wrapped up most of what was happening back in our old home. And I was just stuck here, but I felt stuck here in this sort of limbo of, I knew what I wanted to do. I didn't have a clear way forward. And most important for some of my personality, I didn't have my usual outlet. As much as I go out to work because, you know, it's capitalism and I've got bills to pay and I've got a set of skills and I'm able to monetize those things, but I need that place as much as anyone else who wanders in there regularly looking for a glass of wine and a good time. I need it just as much as they do. And in that period where I was in between, when I was in between two concepts, finishing one and building another, and I didn't have the outlet to go and talk to people and just be open and show people that time, I wasn't able to exercise the muscle that I just knew how to use so well. That really brought me down to like a really, really rough place of, you know, not questioning like, what is this all for? I mean, nothing too overly existential, but it just not being able to use the skill that I know I have so well. I imagine it being likened to like, if you're a young, you know, let's just say football player or something like that, in the American sense, football player, and you've worked so much of your career all the way through, you know, like all the way through like flag football as a young person, through high school, through college, to make it to the NFL. And then in between season, you have an injury. And you know you have all this talent and all this thing that you could add, and you just have to sit benched because of the injury. Now, mine was, I took a sabbatical. I took a break. I did this to myself. I knew what I was doing. But sitting there on the sidelines being like, there's so much I want to do and so much I have to offer, and I don't have an outlet for that. Of course, I'm surrounded by my family, and I have friends, and I have activities and things I like to do.
Yeah.
But to sit there and feel, I don't know, just kind of antsy, I guess, was the best way to describe it. And that definitely brought me to a point where I'm just spiraling around again, not, is it worth me trying to do another one? I knew that was the answer to the thing, but just being patient for the process.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that on the word that this is always going to take time, even if I was to, in, you know, some of those really tough moments, I was like, even if tomorrow I got a great lease on a good spot, I'm still several months away from opening this thing anyway. So taking it back down a little bit, I guess the calm down off of the last concept that I did, which was at the fervor of a busy night down here, and then to just do nothing for weeks on end, I had to really just take a good look at myself and say, who am I without that?
Right.
What is that person? Who is he? What does he do? Because it was a very beautiful experience because I got to realize a lot about myself and who I am outside of my work, outside of being, you know, just, you know, Captain Benji behind the bar, just, you know, doing all kinds of weird stuff, going out there and just sitting around and realizing that, like, oh man, maybe I should go back out. And for me, the answer is always go back out into nature. That's what I got to do. Other than hiking, fishing with my kids, you know, just wandering a trail, finding some birds. I don't know. It doesn't matter. Just being outside is always the answer for me. But it's interesting because when I'm being pushed from behind, I need to succeed and I need to get everything going. I can specifically have a very, very tight tunnel vision, where it's just like, all I should be focusing on now is getting that new thing going.
Mm-hmm.
Where I could have just sat back a little bit more and relaxed. And so it took me a few weeks to sort of settle into it for sure.
Yeah, that's such a good word, you know, feeling benched.
Yeah.
I think we can all relate to that. When you know what you want to do, you know, you're a player, you know, put me in, coach, I'm ready to play. I just want to be on the field, just like, let me do my thing. And you're just like, nope, you're benched. It sucks. So
yeah,
when you're in that phase, when you're just benched and stuck, what emotions, without explaining why, what emotions can you name that you were experiencing?
Sorrow for the loss of Rev's loss, like not disappointment because what I had was so interesting, but just sorrow for relationships I had to say goodbye to, for the beautiful thing that I had built and it's gone. So, you know, just certainly that feeling of sorrow, but also again, that anxiety of, well, when do I get to go back? You know, I know that it will come at some point, but just being trepidatious about like, will this happen? Will the resources run out before I can make it go? You know, like, yeah. You know, starting a business is no small feat.
Right.
So there's certainly the anxiety of, even though I know how to do it, I've done it before, there's always the fear of the unknown, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think feeling that anxiety as well. And then also, I don't know what the opposite of serenity would be. I guess it's just anxiety in general, but that was not a very serene time in my life. I guess I could say it like that.
Yeah, just kind of discontent. There's a bit of mourning.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay. What do you feel like the point of, and this has come up with, you know, your son and then in your example, this anxiety, I think of anxiety as kind of a manifestation of fear. Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, it's the fear of the unknown. It's the fear of failure. It's the fear of things not working out. But if your fears came true, if what you were afraid of happened, what emotions were you afraid of? What painful emotions do you think would have happened if the worst case scenario?
Right. Yeah. Well, this has happened to me before, actually, in my life. So I know exactly what that sort of like deep, dark, you know, you go out and try something. So this is an example of, okay, so going back to a story a little bit, if you don't mind. So, okay, so we left Atlanta to move out to a winery out in Washington so I could just make $14 an hour to literally help sweep a floor and just like figure out like the wine making aspects of it and just start at the bottom and work myself to the top. We literally sold everything, changed our entire lives, and moved all the way out there with this idea that it was going to be, it was going to be this like type of life. And we had a 1-year contract builder. And within a few months, unfortunately, the company that I was working for, they were like, we just can't afford to pay you right now. We thought we were getting this funding. We didn't end up getting it. And they let us go. So here we are, you know, barely 6 months after moving. I've got no job. I don't know anyone out in that part of the world. And that is that lowest of low place. And that is that full and deep existential questioning of, what is this all for? Why am I doing any of this? So as to the emotions that go around that, I mean, certainly in some points, like anger of how did I not see this? Because there's always that part of your mind that's always like, if you just been paying attention to the way I was like to live our lives in like, you know, like 24-hour periods, like in the reverse, thinking, I'd only said that thing differently. I'd only said that, like all the different things, beating yourself up for things that, again, can't control in any way. But that was it. It was like partially like the anger and the frustration about, oh my gosh, I put myself and my family into this like really, really tight place.
Mm-hmm.
And then also just like a little bit of, you know, I mean, just questioning, do I really have the skills? Am I capable of doing all these things?
Mm-hmm.
And that can, especially for someone like myself, who I am an achiever, I like to get stuff done. That is how I self-soothe. That is how I like go through my life. That is how I like, I don't know, that is happiness for me, is accomplishing things.
Yeah.
And so for that, being put, not just benched by my own choice, but even further, like this other experience I'm talking about with this job, that's not just being benched. That's being full on just being like there is just no bench. There's literally nothing for you here.
Mm-hmm.
And to go through all of that really is a deep soul searching of like, where is my worth? Who am I? When am I? What am I trying to do all this ways away from my family and from my safety net? And that can lead to fear of, oh my gosh, I may have just changed our family's dynamic and we may never recover from this kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's the deepest fear of it all. Now, never ended up happening, but that was definitely one of the core emotions.
Yeah. It sounds like there was this fear of just entering into that despair.
Yeah.
And just regret. What about that emotion of shame, embarrassment?
For shame and embarrassment for me, I mean, I go two ways on that, because in one hand, shame and embarrassment, I'm not an easily embarrassed person. As you all know, I'm willing to be and say and do all kinds of just ridiculous stuff just because I think it's fun and I'm having a good time with it. But certainly for, you know, the shame of failure and, you know, being someone who is an achiever. And I know that about myself, you know, your greatest strengths are typically your greatest weakness. So as being an achiever, I can accomplish so much and do so many cool things. But also the hard part about that is that I'm not achieving up to either a goal I set for myself, which since I'm self-employed, mostly just me, or whether it's something else, that shame of not being able to do the thing I wanted to do that way can really, really like, really messes with me, right? I really can just sort of bring me to a place of feeling worthlessness more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. You know, you really are like a brother from another mother, because I can just relate. I have five kids as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, just being an achiever and just kind of having that tunnel vision to be successful. It's really resonates with kind of my experience too. So it's very relatable. You know, I think of, my quest in life is to see the glory of these emotions. So this emotion of fear, right?
Yeah.
What drives fear, you think? Why do we have it? If it's there just to torture you, or how, if you're, you know, somehow the fear is making you aware of stuff, what purpose does it serve? And is there a way to kind of celebrate or change our relationship with fear so that it's one of our best friends instead of like this constant, you know, fear there to kind of like, you know, come out of the shadows and bother us, you know?
That's a great question. I look at it just like any tool in the toolbox. I mean, there are various tools that have emotions. They all have a purpose and they all have something you can use them for, to just sort of either separate yourself from something that's going on or bringing people together. But with fear specifically, kind of going back into, you know, if you were a person living in a cave, And you know, this is like, you know, pre-industrial times. This is like going way back in the day where it was literally just hunter-gatherers to try to figure it out. Fear is necessary, because without it, you don't do so well. You don't survive. That thing that moves and rustles in the bush, okay, if you don't have fear, you might just be like, well, I'll just go check it out. Then you end up finding all kinds of other surprises in that bush that probably lead to your like demise. Now, we've got to be careful about that, because that pendulum can swing all the way to where literally anything that goes bump in the night has you completely like geeked out and you're freaked out about everything. So just like any tool, like I can use a hammer to build a beautiful wooden chest for my kids. I can also use it to smash holes in the wall and like break someone's car, you know, headlights if I want to. Never done that, by the way. Not yet anyway. But that's what fear seems like to me. So it is that fear. So if I'm feeling that emotion of fear, I experience fear in two ways. I experience fear here in the gut and fear of the mind. Mm. Gut is intuition. And I tend to try to listen to that. I don't always do a good job, but my wife is amazing at that. She is so in tune with that part of her gut in herself, whether it's a voice from the universe, however you want to kind of say that. But she just is like, I've got a feeling we shouldn't drive down that road. Or I have a feeling like, let's not do this thing. And she's proven right more times than, I mean, she would love to hear this. Most of the time, you're correct. So, but for myself, I really have to quiet down my mental state in order to hear that voice. But when I do listen to my gut, whether it's saying that person's strange and there's a vibe going on there that you shouldn't get involved with, or something's going on over here, or man, I got that email from that person and something's just not sitting right with me. Listening to that intuition, that fear of, ooh, something's not good here, that uncomfortableness, that's helpful because you can use that. But then the cycles of fear in our own mind, that is more, it can still, there's still some points of fear of the mind that can be helpful. But these days, especially with the world that we live in, I don't see it as being as helpful as it may once have been.
Right.
So, you know, today I like in our, you know, kind of like our cognitive mental state as human beings, as though we're like, imagine like a bird, like building a nest, like, you know, out in the forest, you know, like back in the day. What are they using? They're using all these beautiful pieces of nature, maybe some moss, maybe some bark, maybe some things that they found around. But here in the society that we live, everything is connected to a black mirror staring at our face. we're now kind of like that inner city bird, where if you go and you the work around like the city park over here and you find a bird's nest, there's gonna be plastic in there. There's gonna be all kinds of unnatural, unfulfilling things that, yes, help build the structure of the nest, but they actually either A, well, could potentially be harmful and poison you. But then B, they're just not natural of that world and have been inserted by external forces, like that plastic bag that came from the grocery store that someone threw around or someone threw a cigarette butt out. I mean, here we are in 2023 as humans, we are, I feel like the nest of our mind is actually more plastic and things inserted from externalities than from actually taking a look at the world around us. And so that's why I am a little bit more suspect of fear in the mind, because I feel as it's so influenced by so many things so often that it's hard to really trust that fear. I tend not to trust it as much.
You know, I use the analogy a lot that emotions are like a sixth sense.
Yeah.
It's like colors, right?
Yeah.
And we can see colors, you know, and we can identify, you know, red is red and black is black. And there's really no question about it. Right. With modern society, with modern technology, you walk around and you might see green, but it might be a laser coming from the building.
Right.
It might be making you perceive things differently. So your vision is true and correct. However, with this artificial influx of things, you can't always trust that the vision means what you think it means.
Exactly right.
And so the same with fear, you know, it's a sense. And if we notice it and notice that it's always true, it's there for a reason. It's making us aware that there might be a threat going on. That part is true. However, we have to consider the source of that and the color that we're seeing, the color of fear. Although it may be true, it may be not giving us a signal that we think it is. We might have to become curious and dig in and investigate a little bit to find out, okay, the fear is good. It's making me aware, but what does it really mean? That next step is to try to tune into that wisdom and try to figure out, is it really telling me that there's danger here? Or is it just telling me that this is a false signal so that I can go back to trusting my senses? But like you said, not get caught up in your head and just become overreactive to anything that goes bump in the night. Like, you know, our patients that have PTSD, this like overactive adrenaline response to any little thing, and they'll kind of have an overactive fear response where they kind of can't distinguish what is to be afraid of and what is just not, you know?
Yeah, I know. And that makes total sense, because ultimately, like for many people that I've known, and even for my own lives, whenever there's a piece of trauma somewhere along the way, and then there's a little bit of stimuli that's associated with that trauma. As soon as that stimuli goes off in our brain, we're going right back to trauma land. And that's just what our bodies do. And it's just like, I mean, from a certain perspective, again, going back to the caveman analogy, okay, I saw a slithery thing along the ground. I know that it bit my Uncle Bob. Bob's no longer with us. So now I'm going to have that fear associated with the slithery thing along the ground. But also that can build us into these cycles of whenever we're triggered by a stimuli that is somewhat even tangentially adjacent to what it is the core trauma is, for whatever reason, the way that our wiring works. It's interesting how sometimes one little kick over here will domino itself and then bam, back to core trauma. And we breaking that pathway is not an easy feat to do.
Yeah. And it's a different topic, but for those of you that are interested, maps.org has a lot of the updated information into the psychedelic research on, for example, MDMA, other psychedelic medications that can help to reset that and to sort of cure. I think of it's like kind of, you know, defragmenting a hard drive where you can go through and fix those errors in that processing. Really interesting stuff. Different topic that we could get into another time, but it's exciting research.
Okay, confirm, psychedelics, the best.
Nice. And then, you know, this idea of, you know, fear of shame, fear of regret, fear of despair. And that's a great fear, because we want to make sure that what we're doing in life isn't going to lead to a dead end. We're going to end up destitute. Where our family is going to get ravaged and torn apart by wolves because we brought our family into danger and didn't think about it. So fear is trying to, you know, keep us safe. You took a step further though, and I always am really careful to distinguish between the pure emotions and then the stories that we tell ourselves.
Right.
Because so easily, I think a reason people are afraid of these toxic emotions or these negative emotions, because we wrap them automatically up into a story about ourselves that is often not true. So I believe that it's very important and that we always will sense an emotion of regret, despair, shame that comes. But if we let that wrap up into this self-concept of self-worth, all of a sudden, a pure, true emotion, just a color, just telling us information. The shame is maybe just telling us about our relationship with another person, with society, with something, a situation that went wrong. Instead of just allowing the shame to inform us, we just automatically wrap up. I am not good enough. I am not capable. There's something wrong with me. I'm broken. I'm flawed. I'm never going to be okay. And those self-beliefs can become very damaging and toxic.
Oh, absolutely.
On that.
No, I think you're right on with that because, well, the way that I like to view my mind, or the way that I've learned to view my mind, like most specifically, is just like, I remember that movie Men in Black back in the day where there's like the little alien and he's just, I mean, not literally guys, but like there's a little alien and he's just like punching all the different controls and levers and he is like in the robot of a fully formed like grown man or whatever the situation is. Now, it's not exactly like that. I'm not one of those people who believes, oh, this is just a blood bag and a vessel and my brain is the only thing that's actually working right now. I don't go all the way. I tend to have a little bit more spirituality than that. However, at the same time, like what you were saying, it's like a color. It's just like in the cockpit of my mind, that light is just flashing. That doesn't mean that the whole system has now been taken over by it, but just to recognize, oh, the light is flashing and I need to like feel that and address that and decide where it goes, but not taking it on into your own liking it to what you said, not taking it on and personifying it and saying that this is the shame that I feel. I am shame. I am shameful. That's another thing that, I don't know, they just don't, whether they teach it in schools or not, I don't know, but it's something that my heart hurts for people who take on those emotions so fully and directly themselves. And I've been guilty of it too. There's definitely been times in my life where I'm like, I've lost that sense of worth or that sense of who I am. And I take on either the anger or the fear or the sorrow or whatever it is. And that can become consuming of you if you're not careful.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I deal with a lot, you know, day in and day out, working with the clients and patients that I talk to is there is, you know, if there is even a chance that by experiencing shame or regret or sadness, if there's even a chance that that becomes proof or evidence that you're fucked up, you're broken, you're a failure, you're doomed, right? That is so psychologically terrifying.
Oh yeah,
that most people can't consciously go there. It's such a huge unconscious fear that it's sort of inside of that black box of our mind of the unconscious, where it's like in the shadow world.
Yeah,
and we can't even go there because God forbid if that were true, our lives would be over. It's like you would just sort of explode into this sea of despair. And to try to untangle that and to help people see that the emotions are not evidence at all that any of these toxic stories floating around in our heads are true, I think is one of the most healing milestones to get to with folks.
When you're talking to people and you're having them, is there a pattern that you notice in either the type of person that seems to experience that sort of inner pattern or that inner dialogue the most? Or is it just so free ranging and comes from so many different places that it's just like that this is just something that people are dealing with? I mean, you know, that's why you exist, is to help people work through all that stuff. But do you notice any patterns in them or anything like specifically that just sort of makes me think, okay, this is probably where this person is heading before you've even, you know, like I said, I can kind of judge someone before they walk in the barn. Do you have that sort of sense? Can you sort of say, oh, I think I know where this is headed?
Yeah. You get pretty good at guessing. You know, we're a psychiatrist, we can't read your mind. You know, we don't really have secret powers. We don't have a crystal ball. You get pretty good with your intuition. I like how you use the word intuition because since emotions really are a sixth sense,
right. They
can give you information that you can't get from your other five senses.
Right.
And with that information, you may not know why that I don't think we should go down this road. I have a bad feeling about it.
Yeah.
You may not know why other than you do have that emotion. And that can give you that extra insight to make the best decisions going forward. But when you, yeah, work with folks, it's such a huge spectrum, you know, and you kind of end up getting different types of things that are pretty common. One example that comes to mind is anger. Yeah. I see a lot of folks, and the thing I hear a lot is like, I'm not an angry person. I don't get angry. Anger doesn't exist in my world. Like, you know, my mom taught me well. Or, you know, I don't have hate. Hate in your heart will consume you too. I never hate. And when we deny that we have these natural, the full spectrum of natural human emotions, I believe that we all experience hate sometimes. Yeah. We all experience anger. And it doesn't mean you're an angry person.
Right.
But you may have intense anger, and you may have anger often. And it may, you know, be for whatever circumstances are going on. When people are kind of in denial about having their emotions in the first place, you can see how it plays out into their lives, where the dangerous art of emotional suppression, you know, the subtle art of gaslighting yourself is one.
That's good.
You know, trying to tell yourself that you shouldn't have the emotions that you have. That's a dangerous road. And then people will go down it, and then they'll become depressed, or they'll become anxiety ridden. And most often it's because they've started a battle with their own emotions in the first place. You know,
it's building yourself externally is what's happening. That's cool.
And then sometimes it manifests in somatic symptoms, like they're always getting tummy aches, or always getting migraine headache.
Because they're just at war with themselves in that moment. It's not about the externalities. It's just they haven't come to recognize, oh, this is anger. This is fear. This is shame. This is unworthy, or whatever it is. And just sort of put a name to it. Do you feel like that just even, because like some of the principles of meditation is to simply, like, you know, as you're laying there meditating, and the mind has a tendency to endlessly wander, right? And, you know, some of the greatest meditators of our times are great gurus or people who are just, you know, very well versed in this, say the goal of meditation is to simply just observe, name it, and then set it down and continue to move on. Is that something that you see as just like, just by simply sometimes naming the thing? I can think of an example, like kind of like close to this, just sometimes getting my second oldest daughter, Gracie, if she's having trouble with something, just getting her to talk about it and just name the thing that's bothering her normally pulls about 60% of like all the hot air in the situation.
Right.
So is that like a, just getting people to say, it's like, yes, I have anger. Do you notice like a change in them? Like, is there something, obviously every case is different, but.
Yeah, super, super powerful. I mean, that's the step two of radical emotional acceptance, which is just to name the fuck, name the emotion.
Funny how I weep that, isn't it?
It's really nice. If we hooked you up right now to a functional MRI, where we could see color pictures of your brain, and we showed you different images that were, you know, disturbing, made you feel joy, made you feel disgust, made you feel fear, and we would see your amygdala, you know, emotional processing part of your brain, lighting up like wild. And you just sit there silently as we inundate you with these emotionally evoking images and sounds. Then if we asked you to simply name the emotion, name, that's disgust. I feel like vomiting. That's horrible. The amygdala goes back from this, like, you know, frenzied, lit up state to becoming more calm.
Wow.
And so it's like, if you can imagine, it's like, I did my job. I made the prefrontal cortex aware of the emotional state. Now I can rest. I've done my job. But what we have is people who are constantly in denying those emotions, refusing to simply acknowledge them, right?
Right.
And so then they end up with this battle with themselves. And, you know, I think of a person I know who is, I think, has this irrational fear of shame so much that they constantly live their entire lives just compulsively doing, working, busy,
right,
in denial, because if they allowed themselves to come up for a breath, that, you know, thoughts and fears that, oh, what if I am a failure? What if I am broken? And then I have to live with that shame. It's too much. And so they're constantly driven back into compulsive workaholism. Go.
Because you can drown out the noise. That flashing button over there, you can put a sticker over the top of it and be like, that's not happening. Right. Just keep on driving as fast as you can.
Right.
That I've known people like that too. And that's I feel like it's a quick way for burnout. I feel like that's a way to head to a much larger explosion than just taking care of the engine light while it's on. As annoying as it is, just be like, all right, we got to unpack all this stuff and find your way through.
Because when you finally need a break and you can't just work, it's like, well, I'm going to use a substance. I'm going to, you know, turn my mind. I need something else to kind of just keep it keep kicking the can down the road, trying to avoid ever feeling, you know, the emotion. But the beautiful message is if we can just simply get in touch with these emotions,
right,
then we realize that even though they're painful, even right. though they're scary, whatever uncomfortableness of them, they're there for us. They're just right. there to help. They really are. And if we can learn to trust them and see them as friends, and we don't have to fight all the time, then we can go back to kind of a state of peace in the midst of whatever turmoil of emotions might be going on.
Yeah. No, like as dudes, as men, as like fathers, and on that road, I mean, for myself, I sometimes find myself thinking about just like, okay, what did I learn from my parents? What did they learn from their parents? And how does that all trickle down here? Do you feel as though, because like not, I don't want to blame previous generations, but do you feel as though that epigenetic history certainly has a way of influencing how we're dealing with things now here in 2023? Because as I look around it, as I said, of course, the landscape is different. We have technology that they never had, all that kind of thing. But I feel as though that like sort of like step-by-step generationally can kind of lead people into very specific ideas about their emotions and about who they are. What percentage of someone's like individual makeup and how they choose to react to the flashing light, or what percentage of that do you think is just like, oh, that's just like from who you are and where you come from. That's just been something that's been learned. Mm-hmm. And I mean, good on you, the first generation, try to unpack that if they're coming into therapy or if they're doing work or they're experimenting with psychedelics or whatever. But like how big of that portion of their mind does that take up, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's huge. And, you know, if you look at the different cultures around the world and, you know, the older generations, it's like every culture has sort of its own fashion or brand of like emotional suppression.
Oh, yeah.
You know, stoicism, you have the Japanese.
No, come.
You know, it's like a cultural value to suppress right. your emotions and to come across as just sort of a very joyful, you know, pleasing, happy robot all the right. time, you know, and you never show anybody your real face. So, yeah, I think it's in a way, you know, we are the first generation that's kind of embracing this and unpacking it. And we're seeing a lot of the damage that, you know, sort of have been done. But, you know, coming from history where it was survival, you know, pioneers and
right.
children need to be seen and not heard.
Right.
And, you know, there just wasn't time for it. And, you know, what was passed on to us from our parents, worked for them just to get through. And yeah. so now we have this opportunity to say, hey, maybe it wasn't a problem. Maybe we didn't need to suppress it. Maybe this could actually be helpful. So I love that.
Okay. Right. It's so interesting to me just because like from my own, my grandmother's side of my like epigenetic history or whatever it is. I mean, that's all like rooted in Judaism. And like, what's the best way to go through something, which is complain a little bit about it, make a general, you know, you do a little bit of like schwitzing, kvelling, and then you're out of there. And then that's pretty much, that's all you need to do with an emotion. And then you put it aside, which is something that like, it's another thing that like, I mean, if we're to speak about like my own personal like way through life is using humor, which is like again, like any tool, like there's a tool, humor is a tool that I use all the time to diffuse most situations.
Right.
Like, I'll be off the first one to admit that one. But then also knowing that, oh, that is just conflict avoidance, like to its like maximum degree. I'm so aware of it, both professionally in my life and then also in other places as well. Just knowing that is, I come from people who have done that.
Yeah.
And I know that's what they do. And I know that I do it too. And I already see it in my children as well, that they're going to do that. So it's interesting to sort of just watch that trickle downhill.
Right. Exactly. And yeah, those defense mechanisms, we don't want to throw the baby out with the water because,
right.
you know, it's nice to have humor. It's nice to have
yeah.
Different ways to not necessarily go into our deep vulnerable emotions in the moment, especially with your, you know, with somebody that you might be in conflict with. They might use it against you.
Right.
And so they do have a purpose. As soon as we do have that time to introspect or talk with friends, we can kind of become curious, like, okay, I noticed I made a joke there and it was hilarious and I killed it. But what was I, you know, what was I suppressing? What was I, you know, where were those painful, vulnerable, lonely, whatever emotions underneath it? And how can I learn from them? Because then we can tune back into ourselves and we can get the full picture of things.
Right. No, that makes sense for me. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, not everyone that wanders into that bar is having a good day, like I was explaining earlier. And I've developed enough of a relationship with especially a lot of the regulars that I see somewhat frequently to like really know them and kind of feel like, ooh, you're having a bad day today. What's going on? And it's like, it's always been that struggle for me until I talked to someone who said, you know, this is the way forward for you, Benjamin. This is another therapist I had years ago. And he was just like, the best thing you can do, because my instant reaction is I see someone kind of down a little bit. I just want to jump in there and just be like, I want to pull them back up. I want to save the, but he told me this, like this wonderful thing. And I still use it to this day, which is when people come down there and they, you know, they're talking to me, I can tell they're having a rough time. I ask them a simple question, which is, do you want to talk about it or do you want me to distract you from it? Because that gives them the option to decide how the rest of the conversation goes. Because you know that I'm not above a serious conversation either. It's not all fun and jokes down there. We get into some real stuff sometimes too.
Right.
At least I'm giving them that option, because if they know me at all, they know me well, I'm a great distraction and I'm good at that. But I can also sit down and have a real conversation with them. And so turning that over to them was my way to kind of like, my natural inclination to always go for the joke or always bring everything to levity. That sort of helps me sort of just not feel like I'm just making a joke because I'm uncomfortable here and I don't know where to go. I'm making a joke because they said, hey, no, distract me. Let's just forget about all this for a little while and talk about other things. Or they'll say, actually, you know what? This is bothering me and this is happening over there. And I'm just like, you know what? I'll pour myself a glass and let's just try to talk this through together. Not saying we'll figure anything out, but we can at least talk through it.
You know, one of the keys with psychotherapy is they teach us how to really match kind of the affect of the person.
Right.
So I love how you got tuned into that and you become sensitive. It's like, you know, maybe this person doesn't want to be brought up to the land of joy.
Right.
You know, maybe there's not in that space right now. And so I think I'll just ask. I'll say, what's your preference? So that's huge. And so, you know, when a patient walks through my door, they may be at the top of the world. And I'm like, okay, we're going to have like an experience of a very joyful session together.
Almost a shout out. Awesome.
Yeah. Amazing. And then the next person that walks through, they may be teary and they may not even be wanting to talk at all. And immediately I match their affect and I'm like, we're going to be sad together. We're going to be fucking sad together for the next 40 minutes or whatever that is. And I feel like I'm in such a privileged position because, you know, doing psychotherapy is really my passion and you get to connect with people at like such a deep level.
Right.
And realizing like, you know, that session with the joyful person, it was great. It was awesome. It was sincere. That's where they were at.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy that they're doing well. But you know, that session with the sad person.
Ooh, yeah.
I value that just as much. And I got to tap in, you know, my own empathy, my own sadness to tap into that. And I got to be very sad and rock with that person in that space.
Yeah.
And that's just where they were at right there. And I wasn't trying to change anything about it. And just, you know, that's just one sort of the tools we use to kind of validate like, hey, whatever your emotional experience is right now, come as you are, you're welcome just to be yourself. And we're going to just validate where you're at and try to learn from those emotions, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes by the end of the session, it's lifted and they actually become, you know, but, you know, it's just such a powerful tool to be able to not feel that burden too, because as like a good person, as a good friend, as a host, I mean, when you have an amazing wine bar that's usually a happy festive place, right? And you have such a desire to, you know, give people kind of a good time, that's the context and it's amazing, right? And you're well-meaning and we want to be a good friend. We want to like, you know, be a good parent. We want to like, you know, how can we make you happy? How can we, you know, meet you where you're at, whatever. But to take away that burden, like for me to be a good friend, for me to be a good person in your life, I don't have to fix you. I don't have to fix your emotions.
That's right.
I don't have to make you be any different than you are. I can just find out, just simply find out where you're at.
Right.
And acknowledge that and take a moment to like kind of imagine what it's like to be in your shoes right now and just to be with you anyway.
Right.
And I find when people do that for me, I just feel so accepted.
Well, you feel heard, which will hurt. So many people have lacked that, I feel like, in this world. I'm just, you know, like I was saying about my daughter, she just sometimes just needs to say the thing out loud. She feels heard. She feels validated. And she was skipping right back out the door, you know, like almost like nothing was wrong. And I feel like so many people, because of like whether they were brought up in a way or they're in a relationship in that way or their work is that way. So commonly, I know people who just like, I'm not validated or heard at my job like almost ever. And so there's so many places in this world where you can go to and not get. As a matter of fact, that's probably the preponderance of our like interactions with most people in our spheres is I don't feel heard or validated most of the time. And then when you, and I think that's where like true relationships, whether it being romantic or friendship or otherwise, I think that's where they develop so much deeper, is like when you actually get to that place, it's like, I don't feel like this person has an angle. I don't feel like they're trying to do anything or tinker around in my mind. They're just simply there along for whatever the ride is. And if you can sit back and relax and enjoy that, I mean, you know, the last place that I owned, I had, you know, several years in that space to watch people go from like dating and then engaged and married and then babies and then like start off their career where they're just like, I'm just working as a barista, but I have a dream of doing X, Y, or Z, and to watch them build up. And some people don't. Some people just maintain. Some people go through even rougher times and go down the other way. But to simply be there along the ride with them, if they ask for advice, offer, if not, sit back. But that acceptance at all times for all places, outside of like a few religious places, and we can have a really big argument as to whether we're not actually that accepting or not. There are very few places like that that we can physically go to in the society that we live in where you can actually just do all those things. And at the core of what it is I'm trying to do, that the space to me. That is the bedrock of everything. Everything else is built around that, whether it's the music or the, I don't know, the nice lighting or whatever it is.
Well, that's a great note to end on, I think. Thank you, Benjamin, for being here.
Yeah, man, thank you.
LeBron Wines, where everybody knows your name. It's a local cheers kind of a vibe. And yeah, definitely an awesome place of acceptance. You can be yourself, have a fun time, or not.
Yeah.
You can sob into your wine, but it's totally cool. No judgments.
And wine knows truth, my friend, the old axiom.
Anything, where can folks contact you, follow you? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't do very much on social media, so you can find me on LeBron Wines on Instagram, and that's pretty much it. I'm a very much in-person person, so just come talk to me face-to-face. That's the best way to get to know me, honestly.
Thank you for being in person here today.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was awesome. Thanks.
Appreciate it. Oh, is that now?